We're going to start with a video that was on Nova Science Now a couple of years ago about the sculpture called Kryptos. Kryptos is a sculpture that... Is this working? Can you guys in the back hear me? Okay. Test. All right. So Kryptos is a sculpture at the center of CIA. Can you hear that? Okay. There's four codes on the sculpture. Three of the four have been solved. The fourth has not been solved yet. It's one of the most famous unsolved codes in the world. So Nova Science Now did a segment on Kryptos. This is about 8-10 minutes long. Kind of give you an overview of that particular unsolved code. Then I'll be going into a little bit more about Kryptos. You'll also see me in the video. And then I'll also be talking about a few of the other famous unsolved codes around the world. On Monday, I'll also be giving a talk called The Encrypted Art of James Sanborn. Sanborn is the artist who created Kryptos, and he also created several other puzzle sculptures. And I'll be going over some of those as well. All right, let's go ahead and start. Bring the lights down a little bit.
Spy stories have a secret message, usually in code. But a master spy can always crack it. Today, code breaking involves complex mathematics and relies on powerful algorithms. But even with the best technology, there's one coded message no one has been able to crack. It's 10 feet tall and sitting in plain view in the backyard of the CIA. Correspondent Cohen. Chad Cohen is on the case.
Of all the secrets hidden at the highly secured CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, you may be looking at one of the strangest. Meet Kryptos. It's a copper monolith inscribed with nearly 2,000 very random-looking characters. But there's a message here, if you can break the code. And despite countless attempts since Kryptos' 1989 installation, that has yet to be done.
Now, you're the Central Intelligence Agency, right? You're supposed to be very intelligent. Everybody there is intelligent, right? You don't have anything pulled over your eyes.
Well, that's at least what we all like to believe. But with Kryptos, that's exactly what Jim Sanborn has done. And he is not the world's most sophisticated cryptographer. In fact, Sanborn is not a cryptographer at all. The mastermind behind Kryptos is an artist, if an unconventional one. His workspace looks more science lab than art studio.
I work with lodestones, compasses, you know, the Earth's magnetic field, the Coriolis force. These were natural forces that were invisible. Those kinds of things fascinated me, and I set about to try to make those things visible for people.
When the CIA was looking for a sculpture to grace the courtyard of their new headquarters building, Sanborn wanted to design something that would stay invisible. A secret code. So how does an artist craft a message that the best code breakers in the world can't crack?
I set the codes up for him, which means he didn't have to know the mathematics of it.
Sanborn found help in the former chairman of the CIA Cryptographic Center, Ed Shai, who gave Jim a crash course in Cryptography 101.
Classical cryptography, and it's been defined this way, includes substitution and includes transposition.
For substitution, take one letter or word and swap it for another. Transposition, keep the letters the same, just systematically mix them up. Pretty straightforward tricks, and yet they've been stumping would-be codebreakers for thousands of years. Julius Caesar came up with a system based on substitution to send secret messages to his generals on the battlefield. It's called the Caesar cipher.
A letter is substituted with another letter.
By laying two alphabets on top of each other and shifting one of them over a set number of places, you get a whole new alphabet. The word film in this case now becomes ILOP, complete gobbledygook if intercepted by an enemy. But if you know how many spaces to shift the alphabet over, it's clear as day. The codes have gotten more complicated through the ages. Nazi Germany's Enigma machine, for example, which Hitler used successfully for years before Allied codebreakers cracked it, employed a mechanical rotor system, but ultimately, it just created elaborate substitutions. Transposition ciphers have their place in history, too. To send secret messages to his army, General Ulysses S. Grant didn't substitute letters. He just carefully mixed them all up. Sanborn also employed this technique in Kryptos, using pen and paper.
So this is the plain text. This is the way it's written out in English.
By writing the message on a grid and transposing it to different positions on a new grid, it becomes unreadable to someone trying to intercept it. And the more times you do it, the more complex it can get.
So it can get very complicated.
Very quickly, it seems.
Very quickly.
Complicated maybe to a codebreaker, but it's very simple to the intended recipient. If the code is meant for you, you don't have to break it. Because when two parties want to communicate via cipher, they agree ahead of time on the specific rules of the system. With transposition, you might agree on how many rows you'd use or how many times the chart is flipped. With substitution, you might agree on how many spaces to offset the alphabet. To make Kryptos, Sanborn took both these techniques, used them to encode four distinct messages, and cut them into copper.
Every letter was cut out with a jigsaw, and took 2.5 years of cutting to do it.
Secure as the CIA may be, it wasn't long before Kryptos went mainstream. Through internet message boards, websites, hacker conventions, Kryptos has become a phenomenon.
We have a group of about 1,000 people around the world that are brainstorming this very, very heavily.
Alanka Dunnan, whose website has had millions of hits from would-be crackers, is generally considered to be the leading Kryptos expert in the world. Even Sanborn says so. But she's only seen the sculpture up close once.
Well, because we can't get in to see Kryptos at CIA because it's at the center of CIA.
So Alanka took me here, to the Hirshhorn Museum in Washington, D.C., to see a similar Sanborn piece called Antipodes.
So this is the next best thing. The order of the letters is identical. The punctuation is the same. Part one starts here, where it says E-M-U-F-P, decrypts to the letters B-E-T-W-E-E-N.
Between? Since when does imufpus resemble anything like the word between? Well, since parts 1, 2, and 3 of Kryptos were cracked in 1999.
It all looks like pretty much garbage to the untrained eye.
And here's the guy who did it, L.A. computer scientist Jim Galoodley.
Part of the reason that it's developed a cult following is that I was able to crack it and expose it to the world. So people are able to say, look, some of it really is solvable. It's not just a mass of garbage letters.
Galoodley's programs combine algorithms with rules of thumb for English grammar and spelling. The computer tries millions of different character combinations and throws away the ones that look like nonsense. He's cracked many codes in his life, but he always starts the same way, with what's called a frequency count.
Simply put, he counts. He counts up all the letters in the text and sees how often each one occurs. That works, because in any language, certain letters always show up more often than others. Whether it's a cookbook, a flight manual, or a page from Hamlet, the frequency of each letter will always stay about the same. So in English, on average, of all the letters in any given bit of text, E's make up over 12%, while Q's occur much less frequently, less than 0.2%. When Galoodley studied the first two parts of Kryptos, he noticed there were just as many Q's as there were E's. It was a tip-off that they were probably standing in for, or substituting for, more common letters. Galoodley ran his program on it. Okay, so you type this stuff in. You typed in that code, and boom, this came out.
This came out.
But as the solution for parts 1 and 2 came out on Jim Galoodley's screen, the mystery just got deeper.
Between subtle shading and the absence of light lies the nuance of illusion. It was totally invisible.
How's that possible? They used the Earth's magnetic field. The information was gathered and transmitted underground
to an unknown location. This was his last message.
It's another one to scratch your head.
Yes, there's a lot of here. Definitely.
There was nothing to help reveal the meaning of the sculpture. Just the ambiguous words of Jim Sanborn. Not that it mattered to the man who actually cracked it.
For myself personally, I don't care quite so much about what was being hidden as to how it was hidden.
Galugli quickly discovered that part three of Kryptos was hidden in a radically different way. This one had lots of E's and only one Q, just like it would be in English.
I could tell that it was a transposition cipher because the frequency of the letters was identical to the frequency in English.
Remember what Sanborn was doing in his studio? The transposition he did with that graph paper? Galugli created a computer program that undid it. And eventually, he cracked part three of Kryptos as well. This section was recognizable, taken right out of archaeologist Howard Carter's notebook, describing the moment he first opened King Tut's tomb.
Slowly, slowly, desperately slowly, the remains of passage debris that encumbered the lower part of the doorway was removed.
And then, widening the hole a little, I inserted the candle and peered in. The hot air escaping from the chamber caused the flame to flicker, but presently details of the room within emerged from the mist.
Diary excerpts from famous explorers, mysterious allusions to light and dark. Even when Sanborn's words are put in the right order, they are cryptic, to say the least.
Between subtle shadings and the Howard Carter, I mean, what does it mean?
Well, they all tend to have a common theme of things hidden, things underground, things concealed from sight. So that theme may be something that is going to give us a clue towards part four.
Part four is made up of the final 98 letters on the sculpture. And only by breaking that last piece will the true message of Kryptos be revealed. But so far, it has proven impervious to all the techniques of would-be codebreakers.
Part four is hard, well, number one, because it's very short. It's only 97 or 98 characters. When cryptanalysts are working on a code, we generally have large amounts of ciphertext to work with. Then you're able to look for the very subtle mathematical patterns, which is what takes a code apart.
Is it something really simple that people are missing?
No, maybe not. Maybe not.
And he may have had one more trick up his sleeve, something called concealment.
It could be a matter of obfuscating the language before starting to encrypt.
Ed Scheidt has said that he used a little bit of concealment on part four, but we don't know what that means.
A message can be concealed in various ways before enciphering it, to make it even harder to break.
The first challenge then is, well, what masking technique was used.
Techniques like removing all the vowels first or spelling the message phonetically can radically undermine the code-breaking methods. So it may still be a long time before anyone experiences the thrill of cracking all of Kryptos. Even Ed, who taught Jim how to make code, doesn't know the solution, which makes Jim Sanborn the only person on Earth who does. And he isn't dropping any hints.
It wouldn't help to just kind of get it out.
Unburden myself?
Lighten your load.
No. Mm-hmm. I really like your program, but I'm sorry.
Okay, so I know a bunch of you probably have questions about some of the things that were in that video. Hopefully I'll cover those right now in the slides. So again, I'll be going over Kryptos. I'll be going over some of the other codes I'll be going over today are things called the Beale ciphers, the Zodiac Killer ciphers, Voynich manuscript, and I'll also talk about codes that were considered famous unsolved codes until they were actually solved. So a little bit more about me. My day job is that I create computer games. And it's actually through DragonCon that I even got involved with cryptography. My book here it all kind of started with things that happened here at DragonCon, and very briefly that story is that I was speaking here in the electronics track on gaming, and that way I met some of the other speakers in the track who, as you heard at the first part of the hour here, were hackers or people who were interested in computer security. And so I'd meet the other speakers, we'd have a beer at the end of the day, and they told me about this code that had been released at a hacker convention called Freaknik in Nashville in 1999, and it had been offered as a challenge to the attendees at that conference. The code had not been cracked, though. It had been a year, and so they were handing out the flyers here at DragonCon along with all the other flyers you see around the convention. And I picked up the flyers, took them home to where I live in St. Louis. And then one weekend I just got really bored and I started looking at this code, this Freaknik 3 code, and I got obsessed with it, couldn't put it down, got totally antisocial. All I was doing was working on this code, but I cracked it, and I won the prize, which is free trip to HackerCon, free hotel, drinks, t-shirts, all that stuff. And then I went around and started cracking a bunch of other codes. And in fact, I cracked so many codes, I was actually banned from competition at some of these conventions. For example, at the AtlantaCon hacker convention here in Atlanta, when they released their code, and it was on a sheet of paper, and they had the code at the top, and at the bottom there was a message saying, "Note, past puzzle crackers are ineligible for prizes from solving the AtlantaCon code. Give someone else a chance, Ilanka." And so... So I went and I cracked that one too. Really ticked him off, but you know, I had to. and then September 11th happened, and I was as enraged as everyone else by what had happened with the events of September 11th. And how many people here have heard of something called Bletchley Park? Okay, Bletchley Park was, during World War II, was an effort that was done in England to help crack the Enigma ciphers. And it was a very time-intensive process, very labor-intensive process, and so they needed lots of people who had some of these code-cracking skills for the Bletchley Park project. The way they'd get them is that they would put really hard puzzles into the newspapers and magazines around England saying, "Can you solve this? And if you can solve this, come help with the war effort." And so I thought that was a really neat way to do it. And so after September 11th, I was wondering if maybe I could help with the war on terrorism. So I called up my local FBI in St. Louis, and I said, "Hey, you know, can I help?" And they said, "No." So so I called them back the next week, and I said, "Can I help?" They said, "No." And I was persistent. I kept calling back. Finally, I got an agent who said, "Well, what is it that you know about?" And I said, "Well, you know, I've got all these things with, you know, I've solved these codes, I've cracked these codes." And I started listing off all the different types of codes that I dealt with. And one of them was called steganography, which you heard briefly mentioned in the video when they mentioned to Stego. And the agent said, "Hey, you know, we've been hearing rumors that Al-Qaeda might have been using steganography as a way of sending secret messages to plan the September 11th attack. And we probably have big brains in the FBI in Washington, D.C. that know about this code stuff, but we're here in the St. Louis field office, and cryptography really isn't our mission. Can you kind of come in and give a little quick talk on what steganography is and how it works?" And I said, "Sure, I can definitely do that." And I hung up the phone and went, okay, I got to go really study steganography. And I think they thought I was going to come in and give a little 10-minute talk. I ended up doing a full 70-slide PowerPoint presentation where I went into all my thoughts about steganography. I don't believe that Al-Qaeda did use steganography. Steganography is a way of hiding messages inside of pictures in the Internet. And there were lots of rumors about this. But I did track down some of the codes that Al-Qaeda was using, and then I talked about those. I talked about how to find steganography when you're looking for it. I also talked about where the rumors came from that Al-Qaeda might have been using steganography, which basically traced to in Milan, Italy, there was an Al-Qaeda cell that had been broken up at the Via Quaranta Mosque. And when they'd been captured by the Italian police after September 11th, there were a bunch of computers that were also captured as part of the raid. And on these computers, there were images of naked women. There was pornography. And the Italian tabloids loved this, the idea of why would Al-Qaeda have pictures of naked women? Because they're very strict religious. They wouldn't have pictures of naked women. They wouldn't do such a thing. What were they using them for? Oh, they must have been hiding messages inside of these pictures. And so it was all across the Italian tabloids, and then other newspapers around the world started picking this up as well. However, sometimes porn is just porn and isn't hiding anything. So, yeah. So going on, let's see. All right. So this is, I won't go into details on this, but this was the Freaknik code from here in DragonCon. I did crack it, won the free trip to the HackerCon, hotel, drinks, t-shirts. Not that it's hard to get free drinks at a HackerCon, but it was a good time. And the, yeah, I can buy me a drink and I'll tell you all kinds of stuff about the Freaknik Code. Then after I cracked the Freaknik Code, I wrote a tutorial about how I'd done it, and this is online. I've had to move it through a couple websites, like it was on AOL, and then all the AOL websites came down, and I've mirrored it over a couple other places. It's written in a very cyberpunk kind of tongue-in-cheek fashion, so if you like these kinds of puzzles, you may enjoy the tutorial. And there are puzzles hidden inside the tutorial as well. A bunch of them have been found, a few have not, because they're really kind of obscure, but if anyone really wants to spend time looking through it, there's still some stuff there. So it was through the Freaknik tutorial, through the Freaknik Code, that I heard about Kryptos in the first place, because there were dead ends that were built in the Freaknik Code, and one of the dead ends was, okay, now go solve this, and it was a link to the CIA website with a picture of Kryptos, and I'm like, solve this, what is this, and it's got four codes, three of the four have been solved, fourth hasn't been solved yet, solve this, okay. But it was in the back of my mind, and I really didn't do much more with it at that point. And then, as I said, September 11th happened, and I have a cousin who works in Washington, D.C., who actually had a very close call on the morning of September 11th, because he sometimes works at the Pentagon giving talks about biochem warfare defense projects. And he was actually on his way on the morning of September 11th to the Pentagon, but he was having printer trouble, and so he was running late, and then he got that fixed, and he's on his way, and he checks his cell phone messages, and his cell phone actually crashed from all the people that were calling him saying, a plane just hit the Pentagon, don't go. And the plane actually hit right where he was supposed to be, and so some of the people that he was supposed to brief were killed. And when I heard this story, I mean, all these mixed feelings, I felt bad for everyone that had been injured as part of September 11th, and just the close call that my cousin had was very traumatic. And so about a month later, I flew out to Washington, D.C. to see my cousin, to hug him. We went to the Pentagon Memorial. We put an American flag there. And then we're driving around D.C., and he said, okay, well, as long as you're in D.C., this is your first time in Washington, D.C., is there anything else you'd like to see? And I said, no, really, you. I don't care about any of the other stuff here. And he said, that's very nice. I like to see you, too. But there's a lot of tourist attractions here. Is there anything else you'd like to see? And they said, no, and he insisted. And I finally said, well, you know, there's this sculpture called Kryptos. yeah, I'd love to see that. And he said, okay, where is it? And I said, it's at the center of CIA headquarters. And he said, okay, that's in Langley, Virginia. Let's go drive by. Let's go see if we can get in. And we had a little trouble finding CIA because there's no street address for the CIA headquarters. You can't just go to MapQuest and type in, left, right here. And this was before Google Earth, before all that. But I wasn't going to let that stop me. And so I sort of knew what the building looked like because I'd seen like Tom Clancy movies where they had overhead view, CIA headquarters. And I went and I downloaded a bunch of satellite reconnaissance pictures of the Langley, Virginia area. And I went looking at these pictures until I found the building. And then I could know where CIA was. And I mean, these days you can probably do the same thing with Google Earth. And so we found it that way, and we found where the turnoff was. And there were some other things that kind of confirmed that's where it was. And so my cousin and I, we'd go drive by. And we figured that we're going to take the highway, we're going to take the exit, and then we figured we'd drive around the service road and kind of scope things out. Well, the exit that we took, there's no service road. You take the exit, and you're there. You're at CIA. It's a huge gate, barbed wire across the top, guard shack, bunch of guys pouring out of the guard shacks with guns, asking very reasonable questions, say, right after September 11th, who are you and why are you here? And we're like, oh, we're here to see Kryptos. And they kind of relaxed a little bit, and they said, sorry, that you can't get into CIA. It's official business only. And so my cousin and I are like, can we talk our way into CIA? and so we're like, okay, well, is there ever like a public tour day? And they said, no, it's official business only. And we said, well, can I go to my congressperson and get a special authorization, like a ticket to the White House or something? Can I get a ticket to the CIA to get in? And the guard said, no, official business only. And we're like, we're trying all these things, and the guards are saying you can only get in with official business only. And like I said, these were big guys with guns, okay? So eventually we said, okay, can't get in. And thanked them very much, and we drove away, very glad that we had not been shot at. But I'm thinking about this, official business only. So now fast forward to the request that the FBI had made that I do this talk on steganography, and I'm thinking, official business, maybe I can use this talk as a way of getting into the CIA. So as I said, steganography is a way of hiding messages inside of pictures. And so I needed a picture to hide something in, so I could show a before picture and an after picture. I could have used any picture. I could have used a vacation picture. I could have used a picture of a flower. I decided to take the picture of Kryptos from the CIA and use it as the before picture, then hide a message in it and show the after picture. In the slide, there's no the naked eye cannot see any difference between the two pictures. But it was a great slide showing this sculpture with codes on it to demonstrate a code. And every time I showed this presentation, I would mention, boy, I'd really love to give this talk at CIA someday. And when I gave my talk at the local FBI, they loved it. And there were representatives from all the different agencies there, which was a really smart thing that they were doing after September 11th. And that was one of the things that had been missed before September 11th, is that different agencies were not sharing information properly. So after September 11th, they were setting up these meetings where they would have representatives of FBI and Secret Service and postal inspectors and customs agents, assistant U.S. Attorney General, local law enforcement, and members of the private sector as well, all coming to these meetings. And so it was at one of those meetings that I gave my talk. And the talk was a hit, and I started getting invited to other universities and to other conventions in order to give this, to continue giving the talk. And every time I showed the slide, you know, the before and after slide, I'd say, boy, I'd really love to give this talk at CIA, too. So I was at DEF CON, which is a big hack. It's the largest hacker convention in the world. It's in Las Vegas. And I was sort of a last-minute speaker. I told them that I had a steganography talk, and I knew their schedule was full, but if they needed an alternate, let me know. And turned out that they did have a cancellation, and so they gave me like an hour's notice and said, okay, you're going to speak on steganography. You're going to be in the huge roof tent, and about 1,000 people in the audience, and hope you're ready. And I'm like, okay, and boom, boom, boom. Yeah, my heart's beating really fast because I'd never given a talk at DEF CON before. And at DEF CON, you know, the audience, they know stuff. So if the speaker is dumb, they're not going to sit there and give him a polite, you know, golf clap. They're going to boo him off the stage. So I was really, really scared giving the talk. But the talk went really well, and I actually got a standing ovation when I gave the talk. And at the end of the talk, and during the talk, I did the thing about, boy, I'd love to give this talk at CIA. At the end of the talk, from the audience, people come up, they give you business cards and stuff, and someone came up and they leaned over the table and they looked at me and he said, I work at Langley. I think I can get you in. Awesome. So I met a CIA agent at DEF CON. So they gave me a first name and a phone number. They wouldn't give me a last name, and told me to contact them after the conference. And so I'm like, okay, I called them. And then I'm like, okay, was it really a CIA agent, or was it just one of the guys at DEF CON, you know, pulling my chain and telling me that they were a CIA agent when they weren't? So after DEF CON, I called the number. And they said, okay, can you send us your slides? And I said, well, can you prove to me that you work at CIA? And they said, well, how do you want me to prove that? And I said, well, send me an email from an official CIA address. And they said, well, I don't have an email from an official CIA address. And I said, well, get an email from an official CIA address. So about a week later, I get an email, and it's from a CIA address. It's .ucia.gov, which is unclassified CIA.gov. So then I wrote back to them to make sure that I had two-way communication so that it wasn't just a spoofed email, because you're right, I was thinking about that. And then we arranged that they wanted me to come speak, and I said I didn't want to be paid. I just wanted time, like a couple hours, to sit and look at cryptos and kind of, you know, just get its aura, kind of look at it for a while. And they said, okay, but how much do you want to be paid? And I repeat, I do not want to be paid. I just want time to look at cryptos. And this was a really hard thing. They insisted on paying me, and I kept saying I didn't want to be paid. And so finally, and also I didn't want to ask for so much that they were going to say no. So they kept pushing me on it, and I kept asking people, how much, if you were going to speak at the CIA, how much money would you ask for? Would you ask for $100? I had no clue. And so finally I went to them and said, look, cover my travel expenses. I'm staying with my cousin. I don't need a hotel. Maybe rental car, airfare, $500. But if that's too much, it's okay. And I still want my time to look at cryptos. And then they came back. They came back about a week later, and they said, okay, we want you to come speak, and you're going to get your time to look at cryptos. We're going to pay you $2,500. And I'm like, okay. So this was me negotiating with our government for how our tax money. I asked for $500. They gave me $2,500. So I got in. I was able to see the sculpture. I did some rubbings of it while I was there. They had an official photographer who took some pictures of me next to the sculpture, and it was a really interesting trip. And then when I got back to St. Louis and I had these rubbings, which made a total mess in my suitcase, and I said, okay, someone else may want to see these, and I scanned them, which made a total mess of my scanner because I had charcoal everywhere. And then I made my little a little one page on my website, you know, and it was sort of like an early blog, you know, like his visit to CIA and you know, kind of what I saw, and here's the rubbings, and if anyone else is interested in this, go for it. And then I started getting emails from all over the world, and people would write to me and they'd ask me questions about cryptos because they assumed that now I was an expert on cryptos, because there wasn't information out there. There was just my website, and there were a couple other websites that hadn't been updated in a couple of years. And people would write to me, and they'd say, I've solved part four. And I'd go, oh, okay, cool, tell me what it says, and I'll put it on my website. And they said, well, if you take this letter and this letter and this letter and this letter, it's my home address. It's proof that the government is watching me. And I'd be like, okay, what's your method for can we get a repeatable method? I mean, would an independent cryptographer be able to verify this? And it was always no. And to this day, I get emails, I'd say once or twice a week, sometimes more when there's more, you know, creepy stuff in the news, with people writing in. They'll take like three letters off of Kryptos, they'll go to Google, they'll type it in, and it'll come up with some river in Cambodia, and then they'll write to me and say, part four proves that there's a link between Angkor Wat and Mars. And it's just something in the human psyche that they have this desire to solve these codes. So along with all this other stuff, this noise, I was getting some actual signal in my email queue. And some of it would be letters from actual people who'd really been working on it, you know, cryptographers. And they'd say, oh, well, I found this about the sculpture and this about the sculpture. And we figured out a new way of solving part three and published that. And people would write to me and say, what else has Sanborn done? And I like, I don't know. So I called up Sanborn's agent, and I said, hey, can you send me a list of everything Sanborn's ever done? Because for my FAQ on my website. And the agent said, there's no such thing. And I said, well, I'd like to make a list of everything Sanborn's ever done. And the agent said, it's impossible. He's done too much stuff. I'm like, okay, well, I guess I'll make a list of everything Sanborn's ever done. So I started writing to art galleries, any place that I'd heard that he'd done a show, I started collecting any article that he'd ever been in. So I'm collating all this data, and I'm putting it all on my website. Including, I wrote to the Smithsonian, which had some thick folders on Sanborn, and I said, can you send me stuff? They said, how much do you want? I said, all of it. They said, okay. And, you know, they sent me copies, because at that point, I had the pitch down that I was a bona fide researcher, and I had the best Sanborn website on the web, which I did at that time, which started from one page and then just kept growing and growing. And so through this research, I found out that after Sanborn had created Kryptos, he created another sculpture, which he called the Untitled Kryptos piece, which he sold to a private collector. That one had then gone through various hands and is now in the home of a dot-com millionaire in California. Actually, the guy who founded GeoCities is really into cryptography, so he has an Enigma machine, and he has the Untitled Kryptos piece in his garden. And I went to his home, and I took a bunch of pictures of that. And we found some of these other pieces of Sanborn's. One of them was the Cyrillic projector, which it's installed at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. It's a cylinder light on in the inside of it, beaming encrypted Russian text all around the courtyard at the campus. Well, we put together a team and we cracked that code in 2003. Came out to be extracts of classified KGB documents, which is interesting both that it was classified KGB documents and also how did Sanborn have access to classified KGB documents. So we traced down that story, and so there's a lot of other stories here, some of which I'll be telling on Monday, but this is kind of giving you an idea of just how my website started growing. And then also around 2003 or so, I got a phone call from a guy named Dan Brown, who had just released this book called The Da Vinci Code. And hidden in the artwork of The Da Vinci Code, hidden in the book jacket of the U.S. edition, there's actually five puzzles. And he does this with most of his books, where he puts puzzles in the artwork that are giving clues to the subject of his next book. Well, two of the puzzles that are in The Da Vinci Code refer to Kryptos. So there's an implication that Kryptos is going to be in the next Dan Brown book. And I have talked to Dan Brown on the phone, and he kept wanting me to keep him up to date on what was going on with Kryptos. Now, whether or not this means that Kryptos will actually be in the book, I don't know. But the sequel to Da Vinci Code is going to be coming out on September 15th. It's going to be called The Lost Symbol. I'm very much looking forward to reading it, to seeing if there's anything about Kryptos in it. Also, I've been contacted by another publisher, because each time Dan Brown writes a book, academics publish a book shortly thereafter talking about everything that Dan Brown got wrong. So there's Da Vinci Code to Secrets of the Da Vinci Code, Angels and Demons, Secrets of Angels and Demons. So the new book is The Lost Symbol. The next book by HarperCollins is going to be Secrets of the Lost Symbol. I will be one of the contributors to that book. They've asked me to write something, either about Kryptos, if Brown writes about Kryptos, or possibly about cryptography, because he's probably going to have code somewhere else in the book. Okay, let's get on to codes here. How famous is Kryptos? At this time when I made the list, it was number five. Depending on what Brown does in his next book, that may go up from five. He's definitely referred to Kryptos on his website. He was on Good Morning America talking about Kryptos and making stuff up about what Kryptos said, which really annoyed the artist. So just as another thing in the story, as I was working on Kryptos, and I would give talks, and people would ask me questions, how famous is Kryptos? And I would look, and there wasn't really a good list on the web of famous unsolved codes, so I made a list of famous unsolved codes. And now this is one of the more popular parts of my website, this little simple page. I've had millions of visitors to my website interested in Kryptos, interested in these famous unsolved codes. So then in 2005, a British book publisher contacted me and said, would you like to write a book about codes? And I said no, because I was just way too busy with everything else. And he was sneaky how he did it. He contacted me and he said, we're writing a book about codes, and we need someone who can kind of write a couple codes for the book. And I said, okay, yeah, I can do that. And then they wrote me back, and they said, by the way, we sort of need some more. Maybe you could ask some of your cryptographer friends if they'd write a few puzzles for the book. And I'm like, yeah, okay, sure. And then they call back and said, well, since you're working with most of these expert cryptographers, we have someone to do the easy codes, but maybe you could do the entire section on the hard codes. And at this point, I started digging my heels in and saying, wait a minute, how much work is this going to entail? How much are you paying me for this? So we negotiate a little bit, and they said, what we really want is for you just to write the entire book. And I'm like, absolutely not. I have a day job. I have all these emails in my queue, and they kept coming back. And meanwhile, I'd asked my cryptographer friends to be sending in codes, so they're sending me in codes every week. So if I say no, all these codes are not going to be used. And it was one of them, especially one of the men who was sending me codes, was someone who was actually on disability. He was someone who'd been totally normal through the first part of his life, gone through college, graduated from college, and then was driving along one day and boom, went into a seizure, a full grand mal seizure, and drove into a building. And when they came and they scraped him out of the car and they took him to the hospital, and they at first they thought maybe he was on drugs or something, but what they found out was that he had a brain deformation, which had kind of, over the course of his life, something hadn't been draining properly, and it had been kind of pushing his brain a little bit to the side. And it was he had no symptoms through the first part of his life, then boom, all of a sudden became an epileptic and had other troubles and went on to full disability. Well, one of the ways that he copes with this is he sits home and he works on Kryptos all day, every day. And when he would send me letters, I would have to tell from when he was sending me the letters what phase of his medication he was on. Because on some phases he was completely normal, great, articulate, and then on other phases it was space alien stuff, and it was conspiracies and paranoia. And in between those two, he would have these moments of just creative genius. He discovered things about Kryptos that no one had ever discovered. And when I wrote to him and said, hey, would you like to write some codes for the book, he said, sure, and was just sending me codes. And so when the publisher contacted me and said, okay, will you write the book, and they kept persuading me, and then tossed in a couple $1,000s, and then I was looking at all the codes I've been getting from this guy and from the other people. I said, okay, I'll write the book. And so that was how this book got published. And one of the neatest things about writing the book was at the very end of the book, I put in this big acknowledgments page, especially thanking the guy who had written a bunch of codes for the book. And he really liked it, and his parents really liked it, and took a copy of the book with them to their work to show, look what our son did. And so that was really kind of the most emotionally rewarding thing for me about writing the book. But it's just this huge story, this arc I've had that kind of started at Dragon Con and has gone on and led me into all these code things. And like I said, the next Lost Symbol book. So I really have a huge debt of gratitude to Dragon Con for really launching this career. I wouldn't be here without it. So, going into another code that is not Kryptos. This is the secret of Oak Island. This is a tiny little island that is off the coast of Canada. This is the one that has a huge pit, which sometimes they call the money pit. And it was discovered in late 1700s. Some boys were wandering around. They found this depression in the ground. And above the depression, there was a tree with a branch and a block and tackle. And it was very interesting. Was there something that had been lowered down into a pit there? And over the last couple hundred years, people have done a lot of digging in the area. And when they dug down about 10 feet and they found like this barrier of logs, and they dug down another 10 feet and found another barrier. And at one point they found a stone that had a code on it, and the code said 40 feet below, 2 million pounds are buried. So there's been a lot of research on it, a lot of controversy, a lot of holes dug all over the island. And they couldn't, at one point they couldn't dig any deeper because ocean water started rushing in. So there are some people who say nothing was buried there. It was just you know, some leaves had, they didn't actually find a barrier, they just found some wood, they said it was a barrier, they didn't, the stone that they said they found because they needed investors to pay for them to allow to continue to be digging, and so they had to find something in order for the investors to keep giving them money. It's something that captures the imagination. Is there something down there? Is there a treasure chest? Was it, you know, did pirates bury something? Did the Masons bury something? Did the Templars bury something? People keep working on it. So if you want more information, criticalinquiry.org has some, and probably the most authentic report, the rigorous report, is by the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. Okay, then there's another one. This is the Dorabella Cipher. This was written by the composer Edward Elgar. He's the one that wrote the pomp and circumstance that you hear during graduation ceremonies. And he wrote it for a young friend, a young woman named Miss Dora Penny, and it was on the back of a message that he'd sent, I believe, to her mother or her aunt. And it looks like a simple substitution cipher. It looks very solvable, but we haven't been able to solve it. There's been theories, well, maybe it has something to do with musical notation. Maybe he had a code and he did something wrong. I found out that this was not the only message that he did in this code. There's a museum that has the papers of Edward Elgar that has other scribbles like this. And so people ask me, what would I do if cryptos were ever solved? And I'd probably go on to this one, and I'd probably start gathering all the information that I could about Edward Elgar and go at this one. Zodiac killer ciphers, nasty guy, killed a bunch of people in the late 60s. And he would taunt the newspapers. He would send them these encoded messages, and he would say, my identity is in these messages. And one of the messages was cracked, this one, within a few days, actually, and it didn't have his identity. It said things like, I like killing people. But he sent a bunch of other messages, and those have never been solved. If you want more information, zodiackiller.com is probably the best resource for those. Beale ciphers. How much time have I got? Okay. Beale ciphers, written, a little pamphlet was released in the late 1880s in Bedford, Virginia. And in this pamphlet was a story. And in the story it said that a man had come through Bedford around 1819, 1820 with several wagons full of gold and gems. And he had buried them somewhere near Bedford. And in this pamphlet are three encrypted messages. One of the messages has been cracked. It uses what's called a book cipher against the Declaration of Independence. And it talks about what is buried. The other two messages supposedly say where it is buried and who it belongs to. The question about this, everything that's known about it is really from this pamphlet. There's no other verification. So the general theory is that someone wrote the pamphlet, which was priced 50 cents, as a way of selling pamphlets, perhaps as a way of raising money. It's also possible that it was done by a local Freemason, because Freemasons, part of their belief system is that the search for information is more important sometimes than what you're actually finding. And when you write codes, people want to solve them. They learn about codes, they gather information, and it's a healthy process. And there's even an Aesop's fable about that. I may have that. But let's go in. So this was the second of the ciphers in the Beale ciphers. You can see it's a series of numbers, 115, 73, 24. And what you do is you go to the Declaration of Independence. And so that first number, 115, you go to the 115th word, Declaration of Independence. You take that first letter of that word, 73. You go to the 73rd word. You take that letter. And so this is a bit of the Declaration of Independence. I don't know if you can see that I've got some of the letters, some of the words bolded there. So the 115th word is instituted. So the first letter there is I. So you, I, and then you go through, and I won't read this whole thing, but it talks about how someone has deposited in the county of Bedford several treasures, and I think it's buried in. The above is securely packed in iron pots with iron covers. The vault that they're in is lined with stone, and the vessels rest on solid stone. So it's a very specific thing. And at the very bottom it says, paper number one describes the exact locality of the vault so that no difficulty will be had in finding it. This is paper number one, which again is a series of numbers. Many different documents, Declaration of Independence, Constitution, have been tried against it. Nothing's been found. It might mean nothing. It might be just garbage numbers. And Jim Galogli believes it's garbage because he ran his computers against it. And when he ran against it with the Declaration of Independence, he found a section where it was just garbage, 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 and then it was like A, B, C, D, E, F, G, A, J, 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 K, 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 L, 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 and it was the entire alphabet with some duplicated letters. And some people say that, that means that it was deliberate. What it tells me and what it tells Gilogli is that this was a deliberate hoax, that someone was writing numbers and they were trying to make it look like a real code and they were getting bored. And if you had to write a series of numbers and you were getting bored, that's the kind of thing a human would do, is they'd say, okay, well, now I'm going to do the alphabet, now I'm going to do a poem or something. But it may be solvable. There may be treasure out there. There's a lot of holes dug around Bedford, Virginia, but there may still be something there. Who knows? I would say this is the most famous unsolved code in the world. And that's paper number 3. There are some of the reasons that we think that another reason that it might be a hoax. There are inconsistencies in the language in the pamphlet. For example, they talk about how the gold was found in the Southwest because they'd been driven into a canyon because of a stampede. Well, stampede is an interesting word that did not come into the English language until after this event supposedly occurred. So either stampede was a word that was in verbal language but not in written language, or the pamphlet really was... supposedly the pamphlet reproduced letters that had been written around an earlier time period, and in one of those letters was the word stampede. So that implies that the entire pamphlet was written, made out of whole cloth, after this whole era. Also, just the whole idea of, okay, so they found a bunch of gold in the Southwest, and then they transported it by wagon all the way from the Southwest, all the way to Bedford, Virginia, just so they could bury it. Why all that way by wagon? Why not stop in St. Louis? I mean, there's other large cities you could stop. You could find banks. So why do this elaborate thing about burying? And also, there's no other independent sources of information. It's just this one pamphlet. There's no bank receipts, no hotels that confirm that this guy traveled across. So just as today there are people who create these urban legends and forward it around the internet, this may have been an 1885 urban legend. Someone just kind of made up a story. So this was the Aesop's fable I was talking about, and I'll kind of summarize this, which was a farmer who was dying and was concerned that his family would not prosper because his sons were kind of lazy. He told his sons a story that there was a great treasure buried out in the vineyard. And so after he died, his sons were always out there digging and digging and digging, looking for this treasure. Well, they never found the treasure, but because they were out in the fields all the time, they had good crops, and so the farm was able to prosper. So it was the activity of thinking there was a treasure that gave them the motivation to keep on doing the work. And so sometimes it's not what you're looking for that's the valuable part. It's the act of looking for it that is going to be more valuable. Another code, Voynich manuscript. Really interesting. A few hundred years, it's at least 400 years old. Page after page after page of this very carefully drawn script. Over 200 pages in there. And there's drawings. There's pictures of plants. There's pictures of animals. There's pictures of small people doing strange things in small contraptions. But not like any plants that exist, not like any flowers that exist, not like any contraptions that are known to exist. So it begs the question, what is it? This is just, you can see all of the pages on the web if you want to go take a look at them. So was it a code? It's not like any language that's known. The script is not like any script that's known. It's possible that the whole thing was just a hoax, because there was an Emperor Rudolph in the 1500s. He liked collecting curiosities, very beautiful, artistic curiosities. And I think someone gave him exactly what he was looking for, which was the manuscript, which was a very beautifully made curiosity. It looked as though it was from some other area. He paid 600 gold ducats for it, which was equivalent to about $30,000. And then it kind of faded out of public awareness, and then it was rediscovered in the 1900s by a book dealer. I think his name was Voynich. I think that's why it's called the Voynich manuscript. So there was an article in Scientific American by a guy who said he knew how the Voynich manuscript was created, using something called a Cardan grill, which is where you take a grid of letters and then you lay this grill over the grid, so, and then you write the letters that you're seeing through the hole. And it's an interesting theory, and it got a lot of attention a few years ago. The thing is that no one has been able to reproduce a single part of the Voynich manuscript using this particular method. So until someone can come up with a method that shows how even just a single paragraph of the manuscript was reproduced, that's when it starts to get some credence. Okay, so here's a cipher and an unsolved code that was solved. Edgar Allan Poe, the poet, the Raven, was also into codes, and he did a regular column, I think it was a monthly column, in a literary magazine. And one of the things he told people was that he could solve any single substitution cipher. Single substitution is where you take a single alphabet and you swap one letter for another. Not multiple alphabets, just one alphabet. And he told people he could solve any single substitution cipher. And they would send him these ciphers, and he'd print the cipher, and he'd print the answer. And everyone thought, oh my God, he's a genius. Well, anyone who's worked with codes knows that single substitution ciphers are the easiest possible cipher to solve. You have enough text, anyone can create. It's a cryptogram like you'd see in the newspaper. But he got some attention for this. And in his last, right before he signed off and he stopped writing the column, and he said, okay, for your enjoyment, here are two more challenge ciphers to work on. And so he printed these two ciphers, and no one was able to solve them, or at least no one announced they were able to solve them. And it lasted for over 100 years, 150 years, and then finally they were both solved. The first one was solved in 1992, and the second one was in 2000. You can see that this one was sort of done with, you know, kind of upside-down typewriter text, and this one was also done with odd characters on a typewriter. This one is actually, again, a simple substitution cipher, because if you look at it, you have these things like the comma, cross, section mark here, and you'll have that in other places around here, like here again, the comma, cross, you know, section mark, and through there, and so it looks like a repeating set of three symbols, and as we know, the most common three-letter word in the English alphabet is the, right? So you take that and say, okay, anywhere there's a comma, you put a T, the cross, you put an H, and it comes apart that way, and it came out to be a quote either from a poem or from an early play, I think. And this was cipher number two. This was a harder system. It wasn't a substitution system. I think this was a homophonic where one character could represent multiple alphabets. Okay, another unsolved, this is really old, this is over 3,000 years old, the Phaistos disc. This was discovered near Greece, and we're seeing two sides of a disc that's about this big, and it has a series of symbols, so someone went to the trouble of making stamps for these symbols. Some of the symbols repeat, and it goes around in spiral on both sides. We have no idea what it says. And these symbols are not used on anything else that we've found in the area. So was it... what does it mean? Is it a language? Is this going to turn out to be some sort of Rosetta Stone link between other older languages that we haven't been able to solve, such as linear? I mean, there's linear A and B, and I forget which one was solved, but one we were able to solve because we had an idea of kind of the sound of the language, and the other we don't even have an idea of the sound of the language, so it hasn't been solved yet. But there's people who have written articles saying, oh, I've solved it, and it says this, and some people say, oh, it's a child's toy. Some people say that it was used in religious ceremonies. We don't know. Yeah. Okay. Kryptos, these are the rubbings that I did from Kryptos. Each one of these was done on an 8.5 by 11 inch piece of paper to kind of give you an idea of the size. Let me see how much time we got going here. A few more minutes. So I'll go over a little bit more about Kryptos here, part four. But the reason we say 97 or 98 characters is because we're not sure if that question mark at the beginning is part of the end of part three or the beginning of part four, because part three does end with a question. This is Sanborn. The way that he got access to some of these classified KGB documents is because his father worked for the Library of Congress, was director of exhibitions at the Library of Congress. At the end of the Cold War, late 1980s, early 1990s, there were people who were defecting from the KGB to the United States. Some of these people, when they were defecting, were brought with them suitcases full of classified KGB documents. These documents were then handed over to the Library of Congress, and that's where Sanborn was able to see some of them and make copies of some. I've held some of these classified KGB documents in my hands, and I actually called the FBI up and I said, is it a problem that I'm holding a classified KGB document? He says, well, no, it's classified in Russia, but you're in the United States, so it's not classified to us, so you're welcome to have it. And I'm like, okay, that sort of makes sense. All right, this is Jim Galogli, who I've talked to about some of these codes. He's the one that solved parts 1 through 3 in 1999. There was actually someone named David Stein who had solved parts 1 through 3 in 1998, but he was internal to the CIA, and so it had not been a public announcement. This is the untitled Kryptos piece I was talking about that's currently at the home of the dot-com millionaire in California. And it is the same as the sculpture that you saw in the video, which is Antipodes, except Antipodes is about 20% larger than the untitled Kryptos piece here. And the Antipodes has one side in Latin text, English text, and one side in Russian text. The Russian text, most of it is reproduced on this other sculpture. This is the one at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. This is the one that we cracked in 2003 that came out to be extracts of classified KGB documents. Another thing we discovered about the untitled Cryptos piece, or Antipodes, is it has a different, the text on it is mostly the same as what's on Cryptos, but with a couple differences. One of the differences is that this first part here, the E-N-D-Y-A-H-R line, you can see this is the visionaire table, so we have these diagonals of letters A, B, C, D. And then on in the ciphertext part, it starts with E-N-D-Y-A-H-R. Well, on Cryptos, you may have noticed there's some letters that are out of alignment, but here on Antipodes, they're not out of alignment. I don't know if you can see my mouse moving. Also, this is the beginning of part three of Cryptos, whereas on Cryptos, you know, that's the bottom of the second plate. So where on Cryptos, the codes go 1, 2, 3, 4. On Antipodes, they go 3, 4, 1, 2, and then a repeat, so 3, 4, 1, and then it goes through 2, and it kind of chops off halfway through. Another difference, and this is something that I discovered when I was visiting the sculpture at Bonnet's house in California, is that there are some dots. You see this S dot, F dot. These dots exist only on the untitled Cryptos piece in Antipodes. They do not exist on the Cryptos sculpture. The letters are the same, but there's no dots on the Cryptos sculpture. So why would this one have dots and the other one doesn't? We don't know. If the dots were on Cryptos, they would probably be right about there. It's on a part that we know what it says. The text that would be there would be, who knows the exact location, only WW, and the dots would be there for WW, for the initials. So they might just be meaning to imply to the initials. WW, by the way, we didn't know what it meant. Then we guessed that it meant William Webster, who was the director of the CIA at the time that the sculpture was installed. Dan Brown has tried to say on live TV that WW, and WW, he's got only WW knows on his book. He's trying to say that it means, it's upside down and it means MM, and it stands for Mary Magdalene, which really irritated the artist, who then went public to say, no, it means William Webster. Okay, question in the back.
That maybe he might be using this as a key for the unsolved part of Cryptos?
It's absolutely possible. And he's also done other pieces. He did a whole series of pieces, and I'll be talking about these on Monday, that he called the decoding filters. So it's possible that he has done other art. He tends to repeat themes of art. So if he does something with a compass rose, he does a couple more pieces with compass roses. If he does something with magnetism, he does more things with magnetism. After Cryptos, he did several other pieces that had encryption techniques. He tends to reuse the same encryption techniques. So on Cryptos, we have transposition and we have visionaire, and we found several other pieces with transposition and visionaire. And he's done several other pieces that use binary encoding, 7-bit binary. But there's no binary that we could find on Cryptos. But I think it's very possible that part of Cryptos is done in binary, which is why he even knows about binary to be doing these other sculptures. Or maybe he just learned about it and decided not to use it. It's hard to tell. This is a quick video about how the cipher alphabet is made, where he took a key of Cryptos and then made this letter. So you have the same number of letters, 26 letters in the alphabet, but they're slightly scrambled. And then you take that Cryptos alphabet, and when you line it up, in this way you see you have Cryptos as going across left to right, and also Cryptos up to down, if you read it down the left-hand column. And he did this with two keys, where the keys for solving part one was, the key was, were Cryptos and Palimpsest. And so this was how he made that grid. And you put each letter in the key on one row, and then you line them all up underneath each other. And so you have the Cryptos, so you have this sort of scrambled grid. And then once you have that grid, you can solve. So the top part of Cryptos with the E-M-U-F-P-H-Z, it comes apart there. So like you put E on the first line, then M-U-F-P, and then where the E is here, you go up to the letter B. And so an E becomes a B, and an M becomes an E, U becomes a T. So E-M-U-F-P-H-Z becomes B-E-T-W-E-E-N, between. And you go through the whole code that way, to the message that comes out: between subtle shading and the absence of light lies the nuance of illusion. Spelled occlusion, deliberate misspelling on the sculpture. I'd asked Sanborn if that was an error, and he said, no, it's deliberate. But it's not what it is that's so important, it's where it is. It's the orientation or the positioning. How much more time do I have?
Five.
5 minutes, okay. So I'll go through these really fast. The second part used the same method, but used the key of abscissa. And this was the, it was totally invisible. How is that possible? And it did have there were latitude and longitude coordinates. This was his last message, X. 38 degrees, 57 minutes, 6.5 seconds north, 77 degrees, 8 minutes, 44 seconds west, ID by Rose. Though there was an actual error in the sculpture, and that last part actually says X layer 2, because he missed a letter, and a long story that I'm making very short here. Then there's part 3. This was a transposition system where all the letters were there, and they were just mixed up. And this was the one that came out, if you line them up properly, this was the one that came out to be the quote from the paraphrase quote from a diary of Howard Carter on November 26, 1922, when he discovered King Tut's tomb. Part 4, can't tell you what it says, we don't know. Why is it not solved? Well, it's short, it's only 97 or 98 characters, and usually we have large amounts of text. It's possible there's a key on the grounds of CIA. We may have missed something, we may have been misdirected, or he may have just made a mistake and made it unsolvable in some way. So where do the latitude and longitude point to? On site, they point to right about there, about 150 feet southeast of the sculpture. The interesting thing was 6.5 seconds north. Anyone that's done geocaching knows that a tenth of a second of latitude, very specific location, about 10 feet across. So it's interesting that that's like 150 feet southeast. Sanborn also created, Kryptos is here. This white building is the cafeteria. Sanborn created some pieces here. He also created some pieces out here that have Morse code messages in them. And so these also may tie into some of the parts of Kryptos. And then we already went over that. Don't need to go over that. There was a question over there.
Are your slides available on your website?
Yes. Yeah, all of them are. Although I'm constantly updating them. And so a question came up about whether he put a clue to another sculpture to Kryptos. And that's possible because when we cracked Cyrillic projector, it came out to be the keys of Medusa and Tien. And one of the keys here is the word Medusa, which you can see projected onto the light. And it's interesting because it's not Cyrillic text. Like there's no letter D in Cyrillic. There's no letter S in Cyrillic. So the clue is sort of there. Now where does this word come from on the sculpture? Well, it comes from the third row up on this plate on the other side where we can't see. But if you look at it from the outside during the daylight, right there on that third row, and this was discovered by John Wilson, who normally comes to Dragon Con, but he's not here this year. He was the one that discovered this extra bolt. It's kind of hard to see from this side, but if you look inside the sculpture, it's very clear that there's an extra bolt there, and it's the only bolt like that on the entire sculpture. So it may have been meant as a clue. Sanborn has said no, he just needed an extra bolt to kind of, because the plates were sort of coming apart, but I think that's misdirection. You heard from Ed Scheid in the video. He was sure that part 4 would take a long time to solve. This is another one that Sanborn decorated called the Zola Spy Restaurant. This is next door to the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. And part of it, he's got codes all through the restaurant, and I'll be talking more about these on Monday. He's got this document wall, and these are classified documents in from England, from Russia, and from France. One of these documents has the source code for the Cyrillic projector. So if the solution to the Cyrillic projector is hanging on this wall, it's also possible that the solution to Kryptos is hanging on this wall as well. So one of the things we're trying to do is maybe try and transcribe all of the documents that are there. So, summary. There's many world-famous unsolved codes. Some of them have been hoaxes, which is the reason that they haven't been solved yet. Some are still solvable, and even after 100 years are being solved. But even when solved, codes are often, you know, there's errors and mistakes that are kind of in them. All through them, and sometimes the mistakes might be deliberate, and sometimes it may have made, that's the reason that the code may have remained unsolved. So if you want more information, I do have this book. You can contact me online. I'll be happy to send you my slides. If you want to see that NOVA segment again, you can go to the pbs.org website, and it's there. Okay, we have a couple minutes for questions. Yes.
Yeah. Regarding the solved portions of the crypto sculpture, there, did the alignment or spacing or curvature of the piece have any bearing on the meaning, or was it just purely cipher?
Of the parts that have been solved, there was nothing that had to do with the orientation, positioning, curve, or light of the sculpture. No. It's possible that that may have something to do with part 4 because Sanborn does love playing with positioning and light. But the first three parts could have been solved by anyone that just had a paper text transcript. Any other questions?
This is all new to me, but I was just watching him in that video. He said he'd like to bring in his art the invisible, you know, visible. What do you think, that it's just gibberish? So it's just like that quest to solve this unsolvable gibberish. Do you
I think it's one of the possibilities that he wrote it and it's not solvable, but I believe that it is solvable because Sanborn, I've had conversations with Sanborn, I've gone out drinking with him, tried to pump him for information, and I've also gone out drinking with Ed Scheidt, and Sanborn is actually concerned that part four will be solved because he knows that he's getting more attention for it while it's unsolved. So that tells me that there's a concern. And also with Ed Scheidt, I was talking with him because since I'm a game developer, I know one of the most common mistakes a new puzzle designer makes is they design something they think is obvious. And they don't have anyone test it. And without having someone test it, it's not solvable. Maybe a new puzzle designer will make something that has a mistake in it. And again, since it's not tested, they don't know it's not solvable. And so I was going into Scheidt and saying, how do you know it's solvable? How do you know? How do you know? And Scheidt leaned across the table and said, I'm sure it's solvable. So that implies to me that there is something. It also implies to me that he knows what it says. Okay, any other?
Last question, before, hopefully we can let you go. Does he have any fascination as a person with the more classical ones, like a book cipher? Would he be leading us for the first four toward, since he used transposition and the other mechanisms, would he, and his fascination with ciphers all, he definitely would come across the book ciphers.
So you're asking if Kryptos might be...
For the man himself, you know, has he shown in any of his later works that he might be, you know, he would have to know about him, but
right.
would he be avoiding him, or would he have used it?
It's possible. I have not seen anything from Sanborn to imply that he knows about book ciphers or that he uses book ciphers. It's likely that he was told about them by Ed Scheidt. If he were using a book cipher, the text I'd probably be first to check is a quote by Adam Smith, who was an economist. And Sanborn has used quotes by Adam Smith on several of his sculptures in Connecticut, in North Carolina, in Ohio. So I'd say that's definitely something worth trying, but I don't know for sure. And I've got a whole series of, when I visited his studio, he has all his notes about Kryptos in a briefcase that was sitting there. And there were a lot of times we were having dinner and I was looking at that briefcase and thinking, you know, I could grab it, I could get to the car before they got me. And I took pictures, you know, when they were looking out there, and I took some pictures of the briefcase, and any researchers who want to see pictures of the briefcase, I'm happy to show them to you. Yeah. Any other questions?
And,
okay, all right. Thank you very much.